On this occasion I was strongly impressed to work between the solar plexus and the head, as if I had to clear something away from that region, and that such a clearance would facilitate the severing of the cord at the point where it is supposed to join the head. After about 10 minutes on these lines I felt a sense of relief, which I was very glad to feel, as I knew I could not stay in the conditions any longer. Already I guessed I was arousing some speculation in people's minds as to my rather long visit, especially as I had made a request to be left alone with the body immediately I perceived that the cord was not broken. A few days later, through a psychic source, I received confirmation of all that had been done in this case, and was also told that a well-known minister, who had passed over many years ago, whose presence I had not sensed, had also felt my call for help, and had immediately responded. The astral cord had been broken, leaving the soul free and unperturbed by whatever might happen to its discarnate physical envelope. Several friends have told me of instances where they have had reason to suspect that burial or cremation had taken place before the etheric cord had been severed. In their opinions, there had been convincing evidence that this has been the case, and for many years after, the idea had haunted and distressed them. Whether their fears were founded on fact or not, it seems to me that an obvious and simple remedy lies in having an artery cut the day before the burial or cremation. A friend who is an eminent doctor tells me that it is a very easy and straightforward operation to carry out, so there seems little or no reason for continuing to run such a horrible risk, however slight, of being cremated or buried alive on the one hand, or of relatives bearing the agonizing, even if entirely unfounded, fear that it might have been so. Any surgeon will carry out this simple act, which can do no harm if it appears to do no good, and I advise everybody to leave instructions, not in their wills, which are often left unread until too late, but in some safe place, or with somebody who can be trusted to see that their wishes are faithfully carried out. Chapter 11. Sorrow as an avenue to joy. I soon learned that my husband belonged to the ranks of those who are immediately conscious in their new condition. This was undoubtedly due to the fact that on the one hand his etheric body had been strengthened by the continual supply of drinking water, and on the other by his belief in, and knowledge of, survival in its personal and detailed sense. About 2 hours or so after he had passed, while everybody was downstairs preparing for the evening meal, I went back into my husband's bedroom, and knelt down by the side of the bed on which his body lay. It was the first moment I had had alone with him since the doctor and nurse arrived, and I was glad of the opportunity to pray that he would be helped to progress, and find his right place in the other world, and that if it were right and helpful to us both, that he would be allowed to return to me sometimes. As I knelt there I distinctly felt two solid hands placed gently on my head. They clasped my head, and remained there for several minutes. There was no possibility of the feeling being due to some disturbance of the circulation, owing to my kneeling position. I felt the long, narrow fingers outstretched on each side of the upper part of my head, and felt sure that they belonged to my husband's hands. Often in his earth life when I had been sitting in a chair, reading or writing, he would come up behind me and place his hands on my head in just such a way. The touch was extraordinarily comforting. After a little while I rose, strengthened beyond measure, and went about the many tasks that were waiting to be done. Next morning, I went to the local undertaker's to arrange about the funeral. It was something that had to be done, and I had made up my mind that I would do everything as normally and cheerfully as possible, but in spite of my good resolutions I could hardly refrain from remembering that I was carrying out the very last service that remained to be done for the physical part of one who was so near and dear to me, as countless thousands of bereaved people must feel in such circumstances. So I came back a little dejectedly, I confess. My feet lagged as I approached the entrance to my house. I felt tired, dispirited. I opened the gate, and closed it mechanically, and proceeded up the curving path that leads to the front door. About two-thirds of the way up, I saw my husband standing in front of me, a little to one side of the path. He was trembling with excitement. His face was alight with pleasure and joyful astonishment, as if he was longing to tell me of the marvelous things that had happened to him. He began to say something, and then apparently broke off, and looked at me as if he was surprised to see that I had been out so early in the day, and asked quickly, "Where have you been?" Taken aback by the nature of the question, and the realization that my answer would of necessity seem strange and unnatural to him in his present state of joyful well-being, I stammered out, "I've been to see Mr. mentioning the undertaker, whom he knew. "What for?" he asked. Confusedly and almost apologetically I answered, "Well, you know, something had to be done about things about getting rid of your body." He looked so bewildered at this that I hastened to explain a little more, still stupidly and hurriedly, because the purely material and normal reason that I had to give him seemed so extraordinarily fantastic and unreal in the face of the reality before me. As I explained, his face cleared, brushing the whole matter impatiently aside, he exclaimed, "Oh, never mind about that old body. I don't want the thing, but I've so much to tell you." And then something broke. The vision went, and I was left standing on the concrete path, with the knee-pitter border on each side, staring at the spot where he had been a second before. Gone was my depression, and in its place came the determination to see things through in such a way that could not possibly distress him, because I realized that my dear one had found such joy in his new, healthy body, and his new surroundings, whatever they might be, that it would be selfish beyond measure for me to think or do anything that would impair his happiness, after all the long period of suffering he had experienced on earth. Now, I am not very often clairvoyant, so to me this was an unusual as well as a comforting experience. I told my husband's nieces about it, and we agreed that we would undertake the funeral and all matters pertaining to it as naturally as if we were going to dispose of some old unwanted clothes that he had left in our care to be disposed of. While I am writing these words, I cannot help feeling that these personal reminiscences may be rather boring to some people, but I can't avoid them if I carry out my original intention in writing this book, which was to endeavor to corroborate, in simple everyday language, St. Paul's statement regarding the existence of two bodies, and the part that each of them plays in the personal life and evolution of the individual. So I won't apologize, but just relate to you without exaggeration or repression of any helpful detail the facts that convinced me beyond all shadow of doubt of the immediate conscious existence in the etheric body of the soul of my husband after it had discarded the physical envelope. If this happened to my husband, it also happened to yours, or your wife, or child, father or mother, or whatever the relationship may be of the one who has gone ahead into that region which to many people is a place of mystery, a rather terrifying unknown. Yes, it is the mystery of death, and even of that which we call life, meaning that short period of existence which is spent on the earth plane, which often appalls us. Canon Westcott wrote, "To live is hard, and there is not one of us, I fancy, who has not again and again been tempted to despair of life when he has dared to look upon its dark mysteries, but again, there is not one of us who has not found a great sorrow, a great disappointment, a great trial, an avenue to unexpected joy. If we accept the sorrow, or trial, it will indeed lead us into a better understanding of life as a whole. Eventually we shall be glad that for a little while we were so sad. Of course, long before I suffered this bereavement I believed in the truth of survival, and had had many interesting experiences which substantiated that belief beyond all shadow of doubt, but when someone passes with whom one has spent 27 years of one's life, it is a physical break, and any phenomena that occur that remind one of their continued existence beyond the grave, are more impressive and valuable than any other experiences that one has had in a more general way, fascinating and interesting as they may have been. Probably numbers of people have had more outstanding experiences than mine, but they don't all tell or write about them, so you aren't any wiser. That is one of the reasons that emboldens me to speak of mine, because as someone, I'm not sure who, wrote, "To truth's house there is a single door, which is experience. He teaches best who feels the hearts of all men in his breast and knows their strength or weakness through his own. I can't claim to know all men's strength or weakness as my own, but perhaps I know a good deal of their sense of sorrow and loneliness as my own, and it makes me long to give them something which will encourage them to realize the essential truth of the words, "There is no death, what seems so is transition." Chapter 12. A terrible experience. My husband died on a Monday. Each day we went in and out of his room quite naturally, to see to anything that required attention. We did not darken the room by drawing the curtains. His favorite flowers were beside him, and now and again I went into the room for a few minutes alone, and sent out a prayer to help him in his new life. I had arranged to have his body put into the coffin at the last possible moment, late on the Thursday evening. The funeral was to be on the Friday, at Golders Green Crematorium, because at that time there was no such place nearer to us. Also, my husband had once mentioned that he preferred cremation to burial, and that he liked Golders Green Crematorium, because on one occasion he attended a cremation there, and was agreeably impressed by the surroundings. It was a long drive, about 65 miles. In the one car following the hearse were my husband's two nieces and an old friend. We carried out our determination to be sensible and cheerful, and I don't think any of us shed a tear during the entire day. On the way, I had one clairvoyant glimpse of my husband. He was sitting on a vacant front seat in the car. Whether he then realized the purport of our errand or not, or whether he did realize it, but feeling happy and satisfied with his new condition, he did not at the time attach any great importance to it, I was not sure. He certainly appeared unperturbed, even cheerful, as if we might have been going on one of our motoring jaunts together, as in the old days. I noticed that he was wearing a long, tight-fitting overcoat with a black velvet collar. At the time I could not imagine why he was wearing such an old-fashioned coat, but afterwards I remembered that it was a coat he wore when we first met 28 years ago. Later, at the crematorium, a friend who is occasionally clairvoyant told me she could see my husband with me, and that he was wearing a coat which she described minutely, especially the black velvet collar, every detail of which was identical with the coat I had seen. He had been specially fond of it, and always bemoaned the fact that he had never afterwards been able to get such a good-fitting one. Though it was bitter wintry weather, many dear friends had assembled to pay their last respects to one of whom they had many happy memories. I suppose every one of them believed in survival, as did the friend, a minister, who undertook the service, and gave a most inspired and helpful address, which took away any feeling of sorrow or depression that anyone present might have been feeling. Now, because of this cheerful atmosphere, I was totally unprepared for something that occurred during the service, and in case some of my readers have not attended a cremation, I must explain that toward the end of the ceremony, the coffin, which rests on a kind of narrow bier about 4 feet high, slides gradually toward a pair of doors, which are timed to open at the exact second the coffin reaches them. When the coffin has passed through these outer doors, an inner pair open, and the coffin passes immediately into the cremation chamber, the outer doors closing behind it, just before, or as, the inner doors open to receive it. Having previously attended such a service, I was quite prepared for this part of it, and attached no greater importance to it than to any other part of the proceedings. I think we were singing a hymn when the time arrived for the coffin to slide away. As a matter of fact, I had not noticed that it began to do so, yet at the very second it must have started, I was seized with a violent paroxysm in the region of the solar plexus. It is difficult to describe, because I have never before felt anything like it, and hope I never shall again. It was as if a giant hand had gripped my very vitals, and was drawing them out, together with every scrap of life or strength I possessed. Never shall I forget it. It was not a mental impression of being grasped by something that pulled and drew my very life away, but an actual physical sensation of the most excruciating kind. My internal organs seemed as if they were being dislocated, and pulled out from their usual positions. In sheer agony, yet at a loss as to how to account for it, I looked up, and saw the coffin had begun to move, and was about a third of its way to the outer doors. Still, I did not in any way connect this fact with the terrible drawing on my body, but as the coffin advanced nearer the doors, the internal pulling and dragging on my solar plexus became worse. I felt I was about to die. I still remember the dreadful feeling. hating scenes. The thought flashed through my mind, I hope I shan't faint, and I don't want to die here, just like this. It will cause such consternation and disturbance. How I held on to consciousness I don't know, but just as the coffin began to disappear through the first set of doors, I found that I was instinctively holding out my left hand, not as one would have expected, under the circumstances, to receive help, but to give it. Apparently drained as I was of every ounce of strength, I realized that I was speaking to my husband, saying, "Hold on to my hand hard, hold on hard." Why I was saying this I do not know. At the time, I should have thought my extreme physical distress would have prevented my mind from forming any conscious thought or message. But, as I said before, the feeling was in no sense mental, it was entirely physical. A few seconds after the coffin had entirely disappeared, the terrible sensation left me as suddenly as it came, leaving me with less weakness and fatigue than I should have expected. I then became aware that my husband stood by my left side, against the wall, and was holding my left hand, which was still outstretched. A quick, fervent prayer for help for us both went out from the depths of my being, and I was conscious not only of an immediate influx of calmness and strength myself, but in some subtle way I sensed my husband had also received help at the same moment. The rest of the day I felt quite normal, and able to take part in whatever came to hand. The next day I received a letter from a friend who is very psychic and extremely sensitive to conditions. She had been sitting just behind me during the service, and had felt exactly the same symptoms as I had done, only in a minor degree. She said she felt impressed that the actual cremation, or any fear of it on my husband's part, had no bearing on it at all, and gave an explanation which confirmed in part one that had already been received by me, which was as follows. Because my husband had visited the beautiful places prior to his death, and had to some extent become accustomed to functioning in his etheric body, which he found was agreeably free from the aches and pains that had for so long tormented his physical body, he had not dwelt upon the fact that the latter was the only objective physical link that bound him to me and to our home and earthly surroundings. Except for the one time 2 days before his passing when he said he did not want to go without me. He had been so enchanted with the beauty of the places he had visited, that the tremendous change in his and my relations to each other, the fact that without the mediumship of his physical body he could not talk to me at will, and share my daily experiences, and all the other mundane but happy and tangible evidences of belonging that make physical existence a full and harmonious state, all these hitherto important considerations had been ignored or overlooked. He had visited me in my room, had met me on the garden path, but it was only as he saw the casket containing his discarded physical body moving toward the cremating chamber that he realized that this his body had been the channel, the vehicle through which he had expressed himself to me, and I to him, for all the many years we had lived together. The realization had come to him as a great shock, just as the coffin began to move. He felt a wild impulse to go after it, to stop it, and, as he had always done in matters of urgency in his earth life, he had turned to me, imploring me to help. His etheric body had drawn on mine, so suddenly and strongly that my etheric body was partly dissociated from my physical one, in an abnormally short time, which affected me internally. Indeed, I am inclined to think that under certain unusual conditions, the etheric may actually leave the physical temporarily by way of the solar plexus, though most authorities on the subject maintain that it always leaves by the head. I may be mistaken. An alternative explanation may be that in a sudden dissociation such as this, the etheric body may pull on the solar plexus, though it actually leaves by the head. All this took place in a matter of seconds, not more than a minute, I should think. As soon as he realized the undesirability as well as the absurdity of interfering with a perfectly natural and sensible method for getting rid of something that was no longer of any use to him, something that he was really thankful to be relieved of, he pulled himself together, and grasping my physical hand in his etheric one, he joined in the urgent call for help that was wrung from us both at the same moment. He, too, seemed to recover from the shock as quickly as I did, and I heard nothing more about it from that time on. Whether I got the right explanation or not, whether there is an alternative hypothesis which would appear to be a more feasible one than mine or my friend's, I do not know. I have not heard of one so far. Be that as it may, it was a very strange, and at the same time harrowing experience. Chapter 13. When the melancholy fit shall fall. Are not the days immediately following after the funeral strange, dull, and hopeless? One feels neither here nor there, one belongs neither to yesterday nor to tomorrow. Indeed, yesterday may be full of sad memories, and tomorrow, well, tomorrow doesn't bear thinking about. To the bereaved, all the tomorrows that lie ahead of them stretch out in a long unending chain of hopelessness and loneliness. Tomorrow? No, it doesn't bear thinking about. Yesterday is bad enough, but tomorrow. So we often turn back in our thoughts, and drift into a kind of half-dead, half-alive existence in the past which has at least its memories, but the future who knows? Will it ever again hold any experience that we can share with the lost loved one, anything that we can ever do again together that will in its turn become a happy memory? To say that I felt such desolation as must come to some people would be an exaggeration. I had the great privilege of knowing that death is only one side of the door, and that life eternal is on the other, but alas, while one functions in a physical world, one often reacts wrongly to the many difficult and depressing conditions that may confront one in the daily round of earth life. Keats said, "And when the melancholy fit shall fall sudden from heaven like a creeping cloud, then glut thy sorrow on a morning rose, or on the rainbow of the salt sand wave, or on the wealth of glibbered flowers." It was a few days after the funeral, and things had begun to fall into their usual routine again, that I had my first and worst melancholy fit. I was standing in my little greenhouse, facing a box of overcrowded seedlings, that obviously cried out for more room. Trowel in hand, I started out to carefully pot each half-suffocated plant, when the fit descended on me, just as Keats put it, sudden from heaven like a creeping cloud. Out of it burst the devastating thought. What is the use of doing this? He will never notice it now, or will he? He lives, I know, but will he be interested in such homely little jobs as these? Half my former pleasure in doing them was because I anticipated his eager interest in, and approval of, the results of my efforts. Now, what's the use? I stood then appalled by the thought that never again could I depend on sharing all these interests with him, at any moment of the day I wished, as I had done in the past. Quite suddenly, I heard a voice by my side. I recognized it as my husband's. Quietly, but firmly, he said, "Listen. You have got to go on living. You can't cease living, can you? Then face it, and live it as well as you possibly can. Do everything well. Even this potting, it's an example. Don't forget. You must live, so live well." The stark, obvious truth of this struck me. I pulled myself together. Never since have I felt the creeping cloud to the same extent. As soon as I have seen the least sign of its approach, I remember the words I heard in the greenhouse. Being February, there were no morning roses on which to glut my sorrow, but there were a few buds on the almond trees and some benighted primroses putting forth brave faces in spite of the intense cold. Yes, nature is a healer, and my advice to any bereaved soul who is in a position to do so, is to seek consolation in her in the woods and the fields, in a garden if there is one, or even an indoor plant. Trees, plants, and all living things can and do help us to step forward from despair towards hope. Everything, no matter how humble, that contributes toward that end, should be sought after. I have found that vases of flowers in which the water is regularly changed, and growing plants, are helpful to our etheric bodies, apart altogether from the mental stimulus we get from their aesthetic appeal to our own sense of beauty. They are actually life-giving, and I feel sure that their presence feeds the etheric body to some extent, and makes it easier for it to express itself, or function in whatever way the mind is directing it to do so. We are told that the presence of flowers or plants in a bedroom is bad, because they eat up the oxygen. Whether they do or not, I personally have found them of great help in all spiritual and psychical experiences, and have derived a feeling of physical well-being from them. This may be, of course, merely an indirect result of the spiritual and psychical benefit derived from them. Let us not disdain help from the humblest things that aid us in carrying on with those tasks that must be done, petty, trivial as they may seem to us, who still stand under the edge of the creeping cloud of sorrow. The small things. Life is made up of them. Love, happiness, sanity itself, rests on them. How true are Coolidge's words. One stitch dropped as the weaver drove his nimble shuttle to and fro, in and out, beneath, above, till the pattern seemed to bud and grow, as if the fairies had helping been. And the little stitch dropped pulled the next stitch out, and a weak place was left in the fabric stout, and a perfect pattern was marred for aye by one small stitch that was dropped the day. One small life in God's great plan, how futile it seems as the ages roll, do what it may, or strive how it can, to alter the sweep of the infinite whole. A single stitch in an endless web, a drop in the ocean's flow and ebb, but the pattern is rent where the stitch is lost, or marred where the tangled threads have crossed, and each life that fails of the true intent mars the perfect plan that its master meant. I make no apology for writing in this very personal strain about my own private sorrows and their accompanying difficulties. Are they not common to us all? And if some of us find a way of alleviating them for ourselves, shall we not pass on our knowledge to others, no matter how trivial and commonplace it may appear? Volumes are written on people's experiences in traveling, dieting, camping out, and a thousand and one subjects. Unless one recognizes the value of, and relates one's own experiences, one cannot give anyone else the benefit of them. Few indeed are the numbers of those who have escaped pain and sorrow. We might lose much else if we lost pain, or the power to register pain. Can we realize peace unless we have first experienced pain? Somewhere I read that life is pain, and pain is purification, and after purification comes peace. Thanks be to God, who giveth us the victory. The victory over what? The victory over self, over pain, over all that hinders perfection and keeps the soul in its low prison house of personal desires. So let us take all the comfort we can from nature, and from doing those little acts that may help others along their paths, but above all, remembering that in prayer we shall find our crowning solace. The material aids, such as the beauties of nature, even daily service for others, are only plasters for our wounds. But prayer, which is conscious cooperation with God, sets the real, inner, vital healing power in motion. Praying always with all prayer and supplication in the Spirit, but not praying as if we had to beseech God to soften His heart toward us or to overcome some reluctance on His part to help us, which is unthinkable, but remembering that prayer is our greatest tangible link with God. Here we are, and there is God. His link is the, but where is ours? Whenever we find it imperative to couple two necessary parts of anything together in order to make them into a perfect whole or combination, we fix a link or coupling point on each part. We couple a carriage to an engine. The bolt on the door is useless without its corresponding slot on the frame. In front of me lies a watch and chain, on the watch a ring that fastens into a link on the chain. And this is prayer, the link between ourselves and God. Through prayer we are keeping our hold on His power, and His willingness to help us. Also in prayer we lift ourselves onto a higher spiritual and mental plane, and on that plane the one who has passed over can meet us, and join us in our intercourse with God. It will be to our mutual advantage, I am sure of that. The habit of prayer will lead us to the habit of meditation, or should do. Don't rush into prayer, don't gabble it quickly, as if you had dashed into a post office, and were hurriedly scribbling a telegram in place of that longer letter you ought to have found time to write, and didn't. On the other hand, don't explain too much, don't embroider, don't dwell on tedious details, realize what it is that you feel, and express it as simply and straightforwardly as you can. Whatever it is that you cannot find words for, God will understand. He will find them in your heart, if you are genuinely seeking to give yourself the opportunity to speak to God. After prayer, if circumstances permit, and do your utmost to help them to fit in with your spiritual needs, don't always fit in the latter to your material conditions as a kind of makeweight that you can just afford to throw in. Sit quietly with open mind to God, to His guidance, which will come without question.